Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the wake of Hurricane Michael's devastation, it might be a good time to look at what some leading Floridians have said about climate change. Rush Limbaugh, a resident of Palm Beach, calls it one of the most preposterous hoaxes in the history of the planet. Governor Rick Scott's administration is reported to have barred some state agencies from using the term climate change. And Senator Marco Rubio has been a longtime climate change denier. And they're far from alone. President Trump once dismissed climate change as a hoax created by and for the Chinese. A new 6-part series of short documentary films called Let Science Speak is a direct response to the escalating efforts to suppress environmental science and silent scientists. Each episode features a scientist and a discussion of his or her field. And joining us now are Christine Arena, the series creator and executive producer, and Dr. Dawn Wright, a deep sea explorer and chief scientist at ESRI. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Leonard.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Christine, over the past few years, I've read a lot about a war on science. Did you create the series in response to that?
Absolutely. I mean, as you just mentioned, we are still seeing a tremendous amount of science denial taking place in this country. And the problem seems to be getting worse rather than better. So as new data pours in, showing an undeniable link between warming trends and human activity, the pushback has gotten more aggressive. And so this series is a counter to that.
And when did these efforts to suppress environmental science and silent scientists start to escalate? Did it start with the Trump administration or before that?
Absolutely not. It's been ongoing for decades, but what we've seen since the Trump administration took hold of things is a sharp increase. We have, 162 known government attempts to censor climate science since November 2016. We have over $7 billion in proposed federal budget cuts to science research programs at environmental organizations, including NASA, NOAA, the Department of Energy, and the EPA. Even Trump on TV this last weekend accusing scientists of having a political agenda when Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes asked him whether or not the hurricanes and extreme weather events might be worsening due to climate change, he remarked that you'd have to show me the scientists because they have a very big political agenda. So there is an increase in denial and science repression activities, although those activities have been ongoing for some time.
Dr. Wright, has it gotten to a point where scientists have come to feel science and scientists actually need to be defended?
I think it has. It's not so much as a personal defense, but it's just a concerted effort to get our data and the facts out there and in language and in terms that policymakers as well as the general public can understand, because what we work on can be very complex. There is a certain amount of time that must take place sometimes for us to come up with definitive answers. But it's also one of the reasons why we have bodies such as the National Academy of Sciences, and we have groups such as the scientists who put together the National Climate Assessment Report that was approved by the White House back in November. These are made up of top scientists, normally top federal scientists, who are studying these issues and bringing forth evidence and recommendations to advise our government. And so when that is under attack, I think we do feel as though we need to be defended in a way, and that we need to set the record straight that this is not about politics. It's about public safety. It's about saving human lives, preventing damage to our communities and our economies. And it's from a body of a part of American society that does not have an axe to grind with regard to whether we are with one political party or not, or not. Many of us, I would say most of us, are doing this out of a sincere civic duty. And so that's, I think that's where a lot of us come down on the issues.
Christine, I just read that a lot of the scientists who are working in advisory capacities for the government are being let go and being replaced by political operatives with little scientific background.
That's right. I mean, in fact, if you know, a recent poll from the Union of Concerned Scientists showed that 80% of, for instance, EPA employees say that political interference is a barrier to making science-based decisions. They just removed the science advisory office and replaced, you know, gave it to a Koch brothers operative. So absolutely, there is, we have, you know, we have lobbyists taking the roles that used to belong to scientists. And what that creates is a gap in knowledge and evidence-based decision-making. And these trends are harmful, not just to scientists whose jobs are at stake and who are being questioned and undermined, but to all Americans. Because like what Don is saying is so true. What these scientists do every day is of service to us all, helping to safeguard our national security, our air, our water, our futures. And so much relies on what these scientists do every day. So I would hope that more Americans have become more mindful of this. But it's certainly putting federal scientists in a tough spot.
Dawn, don't some people call you Deep Sea Dawn? That sounds more affectionate than critical.
Yes, it's an affectionate term. It's a nickname that was given to me about 20 years ago, mainly because of my research specialty, which is mapping and studying the ocean floor or the deepest parts of the ocean.
And you do that for ESRI. What is ESRI and how is your work applied?
So ESRI is actually an acronym. It stands for the Environmental Systems Research Institute. It's a software company, a mapping and geospatial data science software company in Redlands, California, which is near Palm Springs. It was founded in 1969 by Jack and Laura Dangerman, and it has grown to be the sixth largest private information technology company in the world. We make the software that is used by most of these federal agencies for anything that has a mapping coordinate associated with it. So one example of what we produce is software that helps the NOAA National Weather Service to do the hurricane tracking maps that we see on the news every day. We have science that underpins pretty much everything that we do at the company, because we serve governments, we serve disaster response efforts. We are in about 7,000 colleges and universities around the world to help them with their teaching and their research. We work very heavily with the nonprofit environmental conservation sector. So my role at ESRI is as chief scientist, which is to advise our CEO and our directors and our software developers on the scientific foundations for the software that they're building, so that the software will help people to do the best science. And then I also represent the company not as a software vendor, but as a participant, as an advisor, as a member of the scientific community. So I interface between ESRI and the National Academies of Sciences with various research institutions, with organizations such as Conservation International and the Nature Conservancy, which do very substantive science as they seek to conserve nature. And I came to ESRI as a professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University. So I brought my deep sea oceanographic expertise with me to the company, and I've also helped to help us to improve our support for oceanographic science, along with the many other sciences that we produce software to support.
Has the growing war on science affected the kind of work that you do?
The growing war on science has affected our customers and users. So, for example, we provide software support to the EPA, as well as to NOAA and to NASA and the USGS. And so we do our best not to move to the left or to the right in terms of politics, but to continue to support those agencies with their software needs as they continue to try to do the science that they've been mandated to do.
Christine, are many scientists, or are we only talking about environmental scientists, reporting that they've been receiving Twitter attacks, evil messaging, other forms of harassment?
Absolutely. In fact, there's some recent data that's alarming around that as well. A number of scientists are coming forward to complain and to talk about, everything from bots and trolls, which are becoming more commonplace across controversial topics, but also personal threats. One of the scientists we filmed for this series, named Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, it lives in Lubbock, Texas, and we actually had to take security precautions even filming her due to the personal threats that she's received. So with some scientists, their lives, every day they have to be concerned about people who are sending them death threats and negative messages, and it's gotten out of hand. We shouldn't live in a country where respected PhDs are afraid of speaking the truth and reporting true data because there are powers that be that don't want them to share that information and knowledge with the country, let alone the rest of the world. So it is very important for Americans to be aware of that and aware of the fact that science is an American issue. It's not a partisan issue, and things have gotten out of hand.
Dr. Catherine Hayhoe is an evangelical Christian and the director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. Is she receiving some of those angry things from fellow religionists? You mentioned earlier the president said there's a political side to all of this. How much of this is about politics and how much of this is about science?
Well, I think it's actually about money versus science. And so it's interesting that the religious community has become embroiled in this. Unfortunately, with respect to Dr. Hayhoe and the threats against her, the majority of those threats have come from people who identify as Christian. And she is a Christian, and that is, alarming to her because in her view, the Bible and, talks about stewarding the earth, stewardship, and values of that nature. And so she feels that protecting and discussing climate change is an important thing to do if you're a Christian and to stand up for your fellow man as well and the negative consequences they may be facing through, the side effects of climate change like massive hurricanes and displacement and heat waves and so forth. So it is becoming a problem, and, she's definitely for, Christians and scientists sort of standing together and coming together. Unfortunately, just to my latter point, it really is about sort of big business and the fossil fuel industry versus science. And so when we politicize this, we need to remember that the fossil fuel industry has been funding anti-science. There are 164 groups in America that basically sow seeds of doubt. They are anti-climate, groups, and their money comes from families whose wealth is tied to fossil fuels. So there is a money trail behind anti-science, and so it has become politicized because that is one of the weapons, to discredit scientists. For instance, this fake notion that scientists are just liberal elites, which is not true, as Don is explaining. But science has become politicized, but really what's behind this is the powers that be and certain profits that stand to be lost if we take proactive action on climate, and that's the bottom line.
Dr. Jacqueline Gill of the University of Maine, one of the scientists in the series, says in her segment that she knows firsthand about the intersection of science and political perspective because of her interactions with her conservative father. What happened there?
Well, Dr. Gill grew up in rural Maine, and her father worked in the coal industry. He is a Republican. He is a conservative, much like my father. And Dr. Gill always grew up with a very acute sense of the earth and wanting to protect it, and was drawn to the natural sciences for that reason. But through her experience talking with her dad, she learned to appreciate his perspective. And that was, it's a beautiful story, actually, one of my favorite stories in the series, because you learn that, you know, just because we disagree politically doesn't mean we have to not work together. We don't need to stay, quote, enemies with those who disagree with us. She shows about how she built bridges of understanding between herself and her father, and that is an analogy for the rest of us in this nation who feel, I think, unjustly divided from those who believe differently than we do. We need to appreciate each other more in this country and find common ground, and that story really speaks to that.
Dr. Marshall Shepard, another one of the scientists in the series, says science at its rawest form is apolitical. He says that scientists' reports are being censored. By whom? By politicians?
Well, partially by the federal government. I mean, there are, you know, the EPA disallows its scientists to speak at conferences. They disallow the sharing of data. So, and a lot of the federal agencies, new requirements are coming down that are insisting that the removal of the words climate change, lack of funding is being given to projects that study this. So that is censorship. When you're told you can't use certain phrases, when you're told you cannot release data publicly, when you're told you cannot share your data with the rest of the scientific community, that is real. That is happening now, and we're seeing again escalated efforts around that. And Dr. Shepard is very outspoken about his disapproval of that, simply because sequestering information is harmful. Why would we that we're limiting the possibility of a future breakthrough? One of his comments on that. Why would we do that? Why would we put ourselves last and allow other countries to advance and prepare based on their knowledge? Why would we sequester ours and ignore it? It's not good for the country.
I'm speaking on today's Leonard Lopate at Large with Christine Arena, who is the creator and executive producer of a six-part series of documentary films called Let Science Speak, and with Dr. Dawn Wright, who is one of the scientists who is featured in the series. Dawn, has that happened to you? Are you being censored as well?
No, I'm not being censored because I do my research under the auspices of the organization ESRI, which is very open about free and open data and research results and making sure that the data are used and seen by as many people as possible. I also work under the auspices of Oregon State University, and our universities are still bastions of freedom where our research and our intellectual property are concerned. But we do work in collaboration with federal agencies and with scientists who do face this, and so it still affects us.
And
because much of science is collaborative.
And you say in your segment that there's a funding crisis for ocean science.
Yes, and part of this is because of priorities that our government is making in terms not allowing our science to advance. And so we've seen federal dollars dry up for many programs and many research projects that were showing very good valid results and showing good progress and contributing to our knowledge of climate change. And in the oceanographic sciences, those sciences need quite a bit of money to fund their studies, because it involves going out to sea on research vessels to collect these data. And these are data that we can't, satellites are not sufficient in detail to collect these data, so we still have to go out onto the water. And so you need a research vessel that costs anywhere from $35,000 to $50,000 a day to operate. And so when that money dries up, and it's very hard to continue our substantive research.
I've been hearing a lot about how the coral reefs are dying and how important they are to the health of the planet. Are we doomed?
We're not doomed, but we are sending out the call that we are in great danger, that we are in crisis. And we need to have, and so this is part of why it's so important to listened to the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's so important to have the entire world participating in efforts such as the Paris Agreement so that we can reverse some of these trends as much as possible so that we can still save systems such as coral reefs. There may be a cure for cancer in one of these coral reef ecosystems, or maybe even in the undersea hydrothermal vents.
But they also provide a lot of the oxygen that we depend on for life on Earth?
Yes, the oceans as a system, with our planet being covered 70% by water and by the oceans, they do, through the process of photosynthesis that occurs in the surface waters of the ocean, in addition to what we call air-sea interactions, the exchange of gases at the surface of the oceans. Many studies have documented now that those processes provide a little over half of the oxygen that all of us breathe everywhere on the planet.
You mentioned the importance of the Paris Agreement. The president said that he has no desire to be part of the Paris Agreement.
Yes, and the president has cited, as Christine said before, there's the financial considerations that he is, Mr. Trump is very much mistaken in announcing that the U.S. would abandon the Paris Agreement. He argued that being in the Paris Agreement would have cost 2.7 million American jobs by 2025 and untold economic revenue. But those numbers, he got those numbers from several think tanks who were opposed to the Paris Agreement from the get-go. And the economics do not bear that out. In fact, there's a group of Stanford University researchers this year that found that by meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement, this would actually save the world tens of trillions of dollars in avoided climate damages, disaster relief, and so forth, which would far outweigh the estimated cost of being in the agreement.
Did you grow up in Hawaii?
I did, on the island of Maui.
Well, there's an awful lot of waterfront in Hawaii. How threatened are the islands?
Well, the islands are always threatened by hurricanes and by other types of storms.
I always think of rising sea levels.
And of course, rising sea levels there. One of the biggest examples of that is actually the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, which stand to nearly disappear due to sea level rise. Hawaii is different because the Hawaiian islands are more mountainous, and they're places for people to go to move away from the sea, from the sea edge. But in places, lower-lying island states like the Maldives, there is nowhere for people to go, and so when the sea level rises, they're going to have to either be flooded or to move, and so it is an immediate crisis for them now.
Christine, a number of the scientists in these films point out that civilization and all of the things that have given us better lives started with science. Has that been lost on the critics?
It has been lost. Science is, you know, it's apolitical, but it's also part of what makes our country great. So, you know, it is the backbone of innovation, and I think Dr. Wright is a great example of that with the work she does at Esri, a for-profit organization. Science underpins everything Esri does. Science also underpins so many of the advances that we rely on every day in our daily lives, from the telephones that we're conversing over to, you know, to the technologies and our food and all kinds of things, you know, are thanks given to us thanks to science. So undermining science really does undermine also directly our quality of life.
They also say that the work of environmental scientists is intrinsically connected to personal values that most Americans hold dear, including innovation, health, faith, civic duty, class, race, and family. That's an awful lot. All connected to environmental science?
Well, if you think about it, science is very connected. And frankly, science has become interwoven into these discussions. For instance, the earlier example we were using of Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, an evangelical Christian, there has been a false dichotomy between faith and science that shouldn't really exist. And so what she is showing is that there's actually a lot of these two things are complementary to one another, not opposed, diametrically opposed. So that's important to touch on that value because a lot of Americans are people of faith, and faith is an important value for them. And so what we wanted to do was address climate change, environmental science, and show how these things that values that Americans hold dear are related. Family health is another example. One of our scientists, Dr. Alan Townsend, who's a provost at Colorado College, his wife died of a brain tumor. His daughter was diagnosed with a brain tumor. It's actually quite a sad story. And science is what kept his daughter alive. He credits science with the fact that his daughter survived. So again, if we remove science from our daily lives, we sacrifice so much. If we defund science so aggressively, we risk so much. And so really what we're trying to do is call America's attention to the stakes and to the importance that science plays in their daily lives.
Dr. Jacqueline Gill says there's no staying in your lane when humanity's future is at stake.
And that's really true, and a lot of our scientists believe that. We risk so much. The latest IPCC report showed, that we are really at the edge of an irreversible shift that will affect all of our children and grandchildren, and that change, when we talk about climate change, these changes are unfolding a lot faster than we're prepared to deal with them. So as Dr. Wright just said, we're not doomed, but we really have to wake up.
Although the recent UN report kind of suggested that if we don't do something, we will be doomed somewhere down the line, not all that far down the line. Yet that's being dismissed. Don, when people say things like that, they say, well, that's just the UN. How do you respond?
I say that we absolutely have to listen to the United Nations because the United Nations is made up of us, the members of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change include fine scientists such as Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. Many of us have contributed data that went into those assessments. The United Nations is made up of member states, including us. So to ignore the United Nations is to ignore what our own scientific community is already saying. It's just packaged in what we thought was a more powerful medium so that people would listen. But I think one of the major takeaways from the recent Dyer report is that all of us need to do our part, and so many of us are driving electric vehicles and we're recycling and so forth. But in the end, the governments must listen. They must take action because it's only through political will that the large, large changes that need to take place in our society will be able to stem the tide. And so this is why I live in California, and so those of us in California and other states like ours that are pledging to go totally free of fossil fuels into the clean energy space by 2045. Those are the types of actions and plans that need to take place. And this is also one of the reasons why there was a recent Global Climate Action Summit in California, because we're not seeing our federal government move quickly enough, or as we've discussed, call it a hoax. And so a lot of the action that's needed in order to stem the tide is taking place at the state and local level.
I like that you said stem the tide. Now, this is not just the government that is being critical. What do you, I throw this out to both of you. What are scientists being told about when people write angry letters or emails or tweet nasty things? What are they so angry about?
If I could jump in here and tag off of the discussion that you're having about Catherine Hayhoe being attacked as a Christian, I think for a lot of people this gets to their core values. This is part of the culture war. Christine brought up that the financial considerations with the fossil fuel industry play a big role, and I think that's completely accurate. But I think another part of this is cultural and people's belief systems and worldviews, their values. And you can give them facts, give them scientific data and charts until the sun goes down, and that is still not going to reach them because they will only be reached on a cultural basis in terms of do they share your values. And so this, again, is why what we are trying to bring out and what Christine helped all of us scientists who are in the Let Science Speak film bring out so powerfully is that scientists are people as well and that we share the same values. We all need to have clean water and clean air. We all have families that we love and want to protect. We all value the beauty of the world around us. And so there does not need to be this strife and this disagreement and this the anger that people have toward scientists and toward science.
I'm speaking with Dr. Dawn Wright, one of the scientists, one of the six scientists featured in a six-part series of short documentary films called Let Science Speak, and with Christine Arena, who is the series creator and executive producer. The images of the destruction that were wreaked by Hurricane Michael were really frightening, but even the sound of Hurricane Michael, which we were just listening to, is pretty scary. And that followed on the heels of another major hurricane that had an impact on the southern states. And yet, we don't have any politicians saying maybe we should reconsider our policies. The president says, well, this is just part of the kinds of natural cycles that we've seen throughout the history of the planet. Christine?
Well, I would even give this question to Dawn.
Okay, Dawn.
She knows a lot. Yes, absolutely.
It's absolutely maddening. It's absolutely maddening and inconceivable that we have leaders who are saying these things. The long-term average temperature of the world has moved in only one direction in the past 115 years, and that's up. We've seen a rise in 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit since the start of the Industrial Revolution. And so that is what is leading to these more frequent, more intense hurricanes, to the more intense wildfire seasons that we're seeing, to the melting of Arctic sea ice and so forth. So this is, it's almost like saying the earth is flat in the evidence, in the face of the evidence that we have there. So, many of us are just flabbergasted, by statements like that. And again, with people's lives, at stake, we've got to do a better job of facing this fact. And preparing for the next hurricane that's going to come, making sure that we are protecting our wetlands and our other shoreline features, the infrastructure of our cities, to be better prepared for these events. But also we have to start taking the measures to stop the rise of global temperatures, and one of the biggest ways that we can do that is to stop the use of fossil fuels. And when the president talks about reviving the coal industry, again, many of us are flabbergasted. The hope that many of us had would be that the communities that depend on coal could be retrained to move into the clean energy sector while still staying in their locations, keeping their culture that is so precious to them where they are, but just doing something else for a living.
We've also lowered the levels of mercury that can be released into the air. I mean, we're allowing more. So if we continue on our current path, is the United States at risk of no longer being the world's leader in scientific research?
Yes, I would say that is definitely the case. There, we are in danger of giving away our sense of self, I would say, even, because to be an American is to be someone who looks toward the future, wants to make the future better, wants to be innovative and leading in that respect. Many of us have gone to see the film First Man, which just came out in theaters about Neil Armstrong and our push as a nation to put the first man on the moon. And that was part of the spirit and the ethos of Americanism that President Kennedy instilled in us. And just hate to see that go away.
Well, how dangerous is what you do, going to the floor of the ocean in comparison to going to the moon?
It's not nearly as dangerous because we don't have to go nearly as far. but to go to the floor of the ocean, many of us refer to that as going into inner space instead of outer space. There is a danger there that something will go wrong with the submersible that you're in. But in the oceans now, we are benefiting from advanced robotics. So there's so many robots and drones that are going into the ocean and taking critical measurements and photographs and other types of images, and in places that are extremely dangerous in terms of the danger of deploying something from a ship in the 40, what we call the roaring 40s, the very stormy parts of the ocean year-round, such as in the Southern Ocean. So it's not as dangerous as going into space, but there is still risk, and there's still adventure, and there's still lots of mysteries that need to be solved.
And you point out in the film that we know more about the moon, Mars, and Venus than we know about our own oceans.
Yes, we do, because of the difficulty of trying to see and to travel through water as opposed to the atmosphere and space. It's harder to see through water. So satellites that are able to quickly take or gather the elevation that results in a topographic map of the moon, they don't have to deal with seeing through water. But our planet, Earth, is a water planet. So it's a more difficult premise for the Earth. And hence, we need to go into that water or be on top of that water in order to use a different type of energy that will give us detailed maps or give us the same level of detail in our maps.
How well have our oceans been mapped?
Our oceans are still 95% unmapped at that level of
Wow.
detail, at the same level of detail that you would use to hike around your local park, or the same level of detail as the interstate highway system maps that we use. So this is why there are initiatives such as Seabed 2030. So we have the United Nations doing their part in terms of climate change. Seabed 2030 is an international group, a mini United Nations of sorts, made up of nations that are trying to get the number from 95% unmapped down to zero unmapped at a high resolution. And they're trying to do this by 2030.
Christine, these films premiered last month during the Tribeca TV Festival. What kind of response did it receive?
Well, so far, we've gotten over 675 million media impressions. So what I have been surprised by and heartened by is the broad audience appeal. For instance, so we got great reviews from the New York Times, Time, a number of publications that you would think would be behind a project like this, but we also got really positive reviews and coverage on Fox News. And when I creating this, it was really important to me to target not just, you know, liberals that care about these issues and that are alarmed, but all a much wider swath of Americans, particularly moderates and those Americans who feel left out and disengaged by today's heated political rhetoric. So I wanted to talk to Republicans and wanted to resonate with moderates. And the coverage on Fox, I'm actually most proud of because it shows that we were able to tell these stories of these wonderful scientists in a way that resonates with new audiences. And so, you know, beyond the Tribeca release, beyond Rolling Stone, articles in Rolling Stone and in the New York Times and others, I'm very happy that we seem to have struck a chord with new audience. And it's very important that the environmental movement and the pro-science movement does that. We can't just be talking to ourselves. We need to engage more Americans with differing opinions than we have in this conversation.
And can my listeners see them now through YouTube or your website?
Yes, they can go to letsciencespeak.com. Every episode is free. This is an entirely philanthropic project. It was funded by donations and grants. There are no corporations behind it. There are no specific agendas behind it. We just want Americans to be able to see these and share these films widely. So they're available on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, as well as at letsciencespeak.com.
You've kept the episodes fairly short. Did you have to cut out a lot of interesting stuff in the interest of brevity?
Well, it's interesting. You know, most Americans' attention span stops at about 7 minutes. So we feel that we did short format so that we could captivate people. And I do feel it was very effective since each of our films addresses a slightly different angle. So I think if you're good at doing short format can be extremely effective. And I think that we didn't sacrifice quality by showing shorter films. In fact, we increased the size of our audience.
My guests on Leonard Lopate at Large today are Christine Arena, who is the creator and executive producer of a new 6-part series of short documentary films called Let's Science Speak, and Dr. Dawn Wright, who's a deep sea explorer, chief scientist at Esri, and one of the scientists featured in the series. Dr. Marshall Shepard is director of atmospheric sciences at the University of Georgia, but also a host for the Weather Channel. Does he discuss these things during his reports on the Weather Channel?
He does. Dr. Shepard has a fabulous podcast called Weather Geeks, and I suggest people Google that and tune in. It's a wonderful series. He talks about a lot of these topics, and in fact, several of his episodes have featured a scientist from the Let Science Speak campaign, including coming up Dr. Wright and also Dr. Alan Townsend and Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. So the Weather Channel has been very supportive of this effort, and Dr. Marshall Shepard as well.
He says science is the glue that holds communities together.
That's because he's seeing all of the intersections and the ways our lives are woven together by science, and he is an excellent spokesperson for that, and he gives very practical examples of the ways in which our, you know, education and our lifestyle is benefits by and is actually made effective by the role of science. So science plays such an important role in so many aspects of our lives, and he feels it's important for communities, and he's speaking from a very personal perspective simply because in Georgia he sees so many of the more disenfranchised communities more impacted by things like climate change. They're more susceptible to the risks that takes longer time for those communities to recover after, for instance, a storm or a climate-related event. And so we need to be mindful of that.
The other episodes feature Dr. Jonathan Foley of the California Academy of Sciences and Dr. Alan Townsend, who's the provost of Colorado College. And Dr. Foley is the former director of the California Academy of Science senior scholar there. He's also, it's been pointed out, one of the most cited environmental scientists in the world. What's been the nature of his work?
Well, he is one of the nation's top scientists in environmental science overall, but he's really, his special focus has been on the food system, actually. So on how environmental realities affect the sustainability of our food system. And so I think he is one of the foremost experts on sustainability and on environmental science from that level. And in fact, he just took a new role. He's now executive director of Project Drawdown, which is an effort that the objective is to try to achieve what's called drawdown, bringing down, basically identifying solutions that will help bridge us and bring us to a more sane future with respect to CO2 emissions, and so that we can kind of mitigate the negative effects of climate change. So now he's leading that initiative.
He also says that we're at a crossroads, which sounds very ominous.
We are at a crossroads because we have to make these difficult decisions. We have to choose to move forward and to get over these political, these polarizing tribalism, this sense of tribalism that you were talking about. We need to get over that and think, see the reality that we're all in this together, that we all have to work together, that we all have a role to play, and we need to start to collaborate. Or we can keep arguing, and we can keep mudslinging, and we can keep questioning reality. And so when he says we're at a crossroads, he means we need to decide, are we going to work together and build a better future, or are we going to remain at odds with each other?
And he says scientists are being attacked on Twitter as frauds and charlatans. Dawn, you say you're kind of spared that because of the nature of your work, but when you speak to other scientists, do they talk about that as a major concern?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They are, Catherine Hayhoe, we've talked about, gets attacked. There are others, others of us who are Christians who get attacked, but I think it's mainly the people who are out front in the climate change area.
But
I have another colleague.
Wait, let me stop you for a second. Why do you think Christians are being attacked? Is this a matter? We said it's not political, but is there something about this that would be considered un-Christian?
Yes, there are disagreements within the Christian community on several issues. The climate, whether climate change is man-made, is one of them. There are still some parts of the Christian community that hold that science cannot be in concert or in harmony with religion. And so if you are a scientist, you are de facto someone who is not Christian, which is absolutely not true. I was trained and still work in the area of geology, so there has always been this tension in terms of the age of the Earth. And there are many Christians who maintain that the Earth is only a few thousand years old, and as geologists, we know that it's several billion years old. And so if you are on the side of what the scientific community has found to be true, you are not on the side of God or on the side of Christian thought, which, again, is absolutely not true. I was trained in geology at Wheaton College in Illinois, which is the college that is well known because of Billy Graham being one of the most famous alumni. So there are all kinds of issues and factions that are at play. And unfortunately, the most vocal people who attack are those who I think are on more of the conservative side of the. Of the issues. And so sometimes there are these attacks. which is very, very unfortunate.
I just read that the last 3 years are the warmest on record, and the 10 years of the greatest loss of sea ice all occurred in the last dozen years. The sea level rise in Mexico Beach, Florida, was caused by a 14-foot storm surge. Can we definitively link the damage from any one hurricane or drought or forest fire to rising carbon emissions?
I think on the longer time scale, we are finding that there is a link. It is very difficult to just take one event and say, well, that is because of factor X or factor Y. But when you look at the last, last 5 or 10 years, there does seem now to be a very strong linkage between the rising emissions, which has caused the planet to warm up, and these more extreme weather events. I've said in my part of the film that the oceans are the engine for many of these storms, and for the rising level of the sea, because the heat that is in the ocean, the heat that the ocean has absorbed from the atmosphere, makes everything angrier. And so you have these bigger storms. You have the molecules in the water going faster and faster and faster. And so that makes the water rise up. And so it is very easy to put those factors together.
Do you think that because we've had this very dramatic weather, people's minds will be changed? Senator James Imhoff, who is famous for taking a snowball into the Senate and noting that it was chilly outside, so there wasn't global warming, he said, and he's written a book called The Greatest Hoax. And North Carolina passed a law in 2012 prohibiting the use of climate science in some state planning. Of course, it was hit really hard by Hurricane Florence. Do you think these things might change some minds?
Ben, I will just say absolutely. So climate change is something that is real to so many millions of Americans. It will affect the money we spend every month on insurance, insuring our homes, insuring our property. It affects the lives of so many of our loved ones who live in regions that are impacted by these storms or by droughts or by heat waves. So the more impact we see, the more direct effects we see and experience, the more Category 4 or 5 storms we endure, that is going to take an economic toll. That is going to take a personal toll. And when it starts to hit home that closely, more Americans will start to ask these questions, because there is no intelligent defense for a decision, for instance, that you just pointed to, North Carolina, to say, let's leave the science out of a decision and a policy, policy decisions that could affect our local citizens. That puts local citizens directly at risk. It puts them in harm's way. So there is no rational explanation for that. And I think as more Americans personally are affected by these crises, there will start to be some significant pushback, and for us, that can't happen soon enough.
I just want to mention that much has been made of the fact that your series features an original score by composer and Fall Out Boy frontman Patrick Stump. Did he offer his services?
He absolutely offered his services. Patrick Stump, for those of you who don't know, just Google him. He's a phenomenal artist. Like you said, lead singer for Fall Out Boy, but is also a magnificent composer. He practically donated his time to score these episodes because he has always loved science. As a kid, he wanted to be a scientist, so he's a science geek. And the fact that he stepped up to do this for us was a huge win, and I think his work really amplifies the emotional resonance of each of the individual episodes.
So people can watch these films free on YouTube or at letsciencespeak.com. And my great thanks to Christine Arena, who is the series creator and executive producer, and to Dr. Dawn Wright, one of the scientists featured in it.
Thank you, Leonard. It was a pleasure to be here.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Christine Arena and Dr. Dawn Wright, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.